You're listening to Sonatas and Soundscapes, your source for classical music on the weekdays here on South Carolina Public Radio. This program is made possible in part by the Paul M. Angel Family Foundation. Recording in the Wells Fargo studio here at SC Public Radio in Columbia, I'm Bradley Fuller. Wonderful to have you along for another special feature on the Color of Music Festival. In store for this episode, excerpts from the festival's 2017 season performance of Samuel Coleridge Taylor's Hiawatha's Wedding Feast, including the tenor aria, On Away, Awake Beloved, plus a conversation with Coleridge Taylor biographer Charles Elford, who joined me via a remote interview from the UK to share some fascinating insights about the composer's life and times. First, though, here's Color of Music Festival founder and artistic director Lee Pringle providing some perspective on Coleridge Taylor's Song of Hiawatha and what the composer's music means to him.
This particular composition that is, you know, a remarkable, I guess you can say, setting based on Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's writings. It makes a lot of sense in so many ways, but it's so broad and so huge. You can't do it in one evening. You have to spread out the piece. So I thought the overture would be a great place to start, and that's the Song of Hiawatha's overture, followed by the Hiawatha's Wedding Feast, which has chorus in addition to a tenor solo. So I had started a spiritual ensemble many years before the festival. And so those singers, along with some other HBCU choruses, joined us on that particular performance in a chorus from Washington, D.C. called the Heritage Signature Chorale. And we had just a wonderful, wonderful time doing that performance. So the highlight for me about that particular evening was having children from the Charleston Development Academy. It's a charter school in a low-income area of downtown Charleston, very close to the Citadel Military College campus. And those children were our guests in the audience. And many of them, this was their first time seeing a symphonic work. And it brought a lot of joy to my heart to know that there were young Black kids at an age like I was when music was, you know, introduced into my life in that way, to go to their first concert. And the major work on the program that they had in their hand was of a gentleman that looked like them. He literally has what we would call an afro in his picture, one of the pictures of Samuel Coleridge Taylor. So that really touched my heart, and it was a very, very transcendent moment for me.
That was Lee Pringle, founder and artistic director of the Color of Music Festival. We'll hear now one of the pieces just mentioned, the overture to the Song of Hiawatha, that trilogy of cantatas by Samuel Coleridge Taylor. Kazim Abdullah leads the 2017 Color of Music Festival Orchestra for the performance.
Thank you.
That was the Overture to the Song of Hiawatha by Samuel Coleridge Taylor. Kazim Abdullah conducted the 2017 Colored Music Festival Orchestra in Charleston's Gilliard Center for that performance. Recently, I also had the chance to speak with Coleridge Taylor biographer Charles Elford, author of Black Mahler, The Samuel Coleridge Taylor Story. Here's the conversation we had. Charles, thanks so much for joining today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It's a great privilege to be here to talk about a hero of mine.
Well, speaking of this hero of yours, you've written both a screenplay and a book on him, Samuel Coleridge Taylor. That book, namely, is Black Mahler, The Samuel Coleridge Taylor Story. Certainly, there's a lot that might be said about this composer. But to get started, could you provide a brief biography, maybe some highlights of his life and a character sketch?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult sort of compressing a 37-year life into a couple of seconds. But I mean, I first heard about him in an article way back in 2004 in the Evening Standard, where they relaunched a recording of his violin concerto. And I just suddenly thought, why have I not heard of this person when I started to hear a little bit about his life? So I started researching it. And the more I uncovered, the more I thought, with my ex-actor hat on, that it would just make the most amazing screenplay. So I wrote a screenplay to start off with and was touting that around. And the thought was that, yes, it is a brilliant story, and they thought it was well told, but that he was just too obscure. So it's very sad that a sort of a superstar, a transatlantic superstar of his day, is now all but forgotten and very often confused with the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge. So in a nutshell, he was born in 1875. His mother was white and English. He was born in Holborn in London. And his father was a black doctor from Sierra Leone called Dr. Daniel Peter Hughes Taylor. But shortly after his birth, Dr. Taylor moved back to Sierra Leone, and Mrs. Evans, his mother, then moved out to Croydon and married there. So that's the basics. I suppose when he was about 8 years old, he gave a violin performance at his local church hall. And that's where he really started to get people's attention, because he was clearly very, very talented. And the fact that he was mixed race in a very, very white Victorian Edwardian England made him a little bit of a curiosity. I don't think he sort of experienced racism, because it was just so unusual at the time. But after that, he sort of was championed by a local man called Colonel Herbert Walters, who funded his training at the Royal College of Music, where he started off as a violinist, but very quickly he switched to composition. And just to give you the background of the kind of company he was keeping there, his teachers were people like Sir Frederick Bridge, Hubert Parry, Walter Parrott. I don't know if these names mean anything to you, but in the sort of the English classical musical world at the time and now, they were, you know, very, very big names. His fellow students were people like William Hurlston, who was a lifelong friend, who also died tragically young. Ralph Vaughan Williams, Gustav von Holst, these were all colleagues of his when he was training.
And another one of his classmates at the Royal College of Music would end up being his wife.
That's correct. That's correct. He met her there. They married a few years later on. I mean, in those days, people courted for quite a long time, and I think that was the same with him. He was teaching privately in Croydon when he was a student. And I suppose a key point was in 1896, when an African-American poet called Paul Laurence Dunbar was touring the UK, and he met up with Samuel Coleridge Taylor in London, and they did a recital together in London. And then as a result of that, they collaborated together, and Coleridge Taylor set some of Dunbar's poems to music. So that was the first sort of bit of composition. I suppose the next big break he had was when Sir Edward Elgar, who was, you know, championing his work, was asked to compose a piece for a very famous music festival at the time. And he had done it a few years in a row and didn't have time that particular year. So he suggested they asked Samuel Coleridge Taylor to do it. So he wrote his ballad in A minor for that, and it was later performed again at the Crystal Palace in November of that year. And so this was really his career starting to sort of take on a bit of a life of its own. And in his personal life, he was very interested in the written word, and he loved the Longfellow poem Hiawatha, which I know you're interested to hear about. And he wrote a piece, Hiawatha's Wedding Feast. And it's difficult to know why, but he was clearly inspired by the poem. I think it's a very musical poem in its sort of inherent rhythm, and it suited his musical writing style as well. Later on, people very often likened him to his hero. One of the key points of the Hiawatha story is not only his marriage to Minnehaha, her sudden death, and then his departure to the other world, but during his life in this poem, Hiawatha brought together the warring tribes of America at the time. And I think many people saw Coleridge Taylor as doing a similar thing, but through his music, he united people, different classes, different races, different ages, different genders. Somehow he brought people together, and I think that was his big gift. He was a peacemaker. There's a guy called Havergal Brian who basically who knew him personally and said quite a lot of things about him. And he described Coleridge Taylor as being everything like Hiawatha. He was very, very similar in many ways in the way he sort of united people.
Well, this is a fascinating point you're making, because already if you look at kind of what's going into his trilogy, The Song of Hiawatha, there's a composer of mixed race background, English mother, Sierra Leone father, and then he's setting a work by a white American poet, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, which is in turn inspired by Native American folklore. So there seems to be all these cultural influences here. Would it be too much of a stretch to liken this to the West Side Story of its day?
I don't think it would be a stretch at all. In that original article that I mentioned by Norman LeBrecht, he was saying that Coleridge Taylor was a bit like an Andrew Lloyd Webber of his day. He was a megastar. And I think that one of the things that was so popular about him was at the time there were choral societies all over the country. And I think they were probably getting a little bit sick of singing things like Handel's Messiah year after year. So when a wonderful piece of choral music came along with a sort of a secular background to it that was fun to sing and easy to sing, it just took off. It took on a life of its own. It was very, very new at the time, and it was hugely popular. He did make a mistake. He was a young man. He was just coming out of college, and he did make the mistake of selling it directly to Novello for an outright fee. So he didn't ever benefit from getting royalty payments from it. And I worked out, basically, he sold it for 15 guineas, which is the equivalent of about £2,000 today, or just under $3,000 in the US. So it's a significant amount of money, but he could have been the equivalent of a multimillionaire if he'd not sold the rights outright to Novello and had, you know, received royalty payments. But this was a kind of a mistake which he repeated a few times. He wrote The Death of Minnehaha, and that was premiered by the Royal Choral Society in 1899. And then he made it a trilogy with Hiawatha's Departure in 1900, and performed it as a trilogy with a new overture. And I think by this point, some of his early champions possibly saw him as a little bit of a threat. Elgar was very, very scathing of Hiawatha's overture, because it totally eclipsed Elgar's premiere of The Dream of Gerontius when it came out. He actually described it, Hiawatha's overture, as rot, which isn't very flattering at all. I think he saw Coleridge Taylor as a popular composer, but possibly because it was modern and he was young, it was unorthodox. There's a famous conductor, a composer rather, Arthur Sullivan of Gilbert and Sullivan, who wrote sort of popular comic operas at the time. And he got off his sick bed to, he was dying, and he went to the premiere of one of Coleridge Taylor's pieces and said, in comparison to you, a great composer, I'm just a music maker. So from such again, he was a megastar of the day. For someone like that to be so passionately praising Coleridge Taylor, it was extraordinary that Elgar should sort of describe the overture to Hiawatha as rot. It clearly isn't. I think he did feel very threatened.
Well, I mean, in this fame, starting, you mentioned Hubert Parry of Jerusalem fame. I think that's a piece that a lot in America would know as well. And Arthur Sullivan of Gilbert and Sullivan, of course, all those comic operettas, they're fans from the start. But this isn't just a hit with the critics, the musicians who know about it, but really popular. Like you said, it's a popular hit in England, but also it makes its way to America as well.
Well, that's right. Something slightly different happened in America, which is fascinating, because he didn't really experience racism in the UK. As I say, he was seen more as a curiosity, I think. And there's a lovely story where he was on a train going to Rochester in Kent, which is where I live, from London. And it was quite a long train journey. And he was sitting opposite a clergyman, a vicar. And this person was trying to strike up a conversation with Coleridge Taylor. And they were looking out of the window and they saw these, Kent's famous for its orchards and fruit growing and hops growing, which obviously made use for making beer. And the vicar sort of looked at the hops and said, isn't it wonderful? But I probably shouldn't approve. And then he said to Coleridge Taylor, and do you grow hops in Japan? So, I mean, he met this kind of ignorance and I suppose racism with humour and mild irritation occasionally, but it wasn't anything like what he experienced in America. He, in 1904, he was invited out by the Samuel Coleridge Taylor Choral Society that was in America at the time, and he met people like Booker T. Washington. And he actually did a preface to a series of pieces of music that Coleridge Taylor wrote called 24 Negro Melodies. And I'll just read you what Booker T. Washington said. He said, it is especially gratifying that at this time when interest in the plantation songs seems to be dying out with the generation that gave them birth, the most cultivated musician of his race, a man of the highest aesthetic ideals, should give permanence to the folk songs of his people by giving them a new interpretation and an added dignity. And Coleridge Taylor himself said that what Brahms did with Hungarian folk music and what Dvorak did for Bohemian folk music and what Grieg did for the Norwegian folk music, this is what he tried to do with these African-American spiritual songs of that slave generation. And there's another bit I'd like to read to you, which again, I think is just gives that sense of what he meant to people in America. It was when he was conducting in Washington in the US, and a correspondent reported, and this is what this correspondent said at the time, when Samuel Coleridge Taylor of London walked upon the platform of Convention Hall last Wednesday night and made his bow to 4,000 people, the event marked an epoch in the history of the Negro race of the world. It was the first time that a man with African blood in his veins ever held a baton over the heads of the members of the great Marine Band. There too was a chorus of more than 200 voices, the best aggregation of singers, white or coloured, Washington has ever seen. And what a wonderful performance did band, chorus, soloists and leader give. The whole affair was simply indescribable, and we may never see its like again. The occasion was an inspiration. So he was seen in a very different way, I think, in America to how he was seen in the UK, where he was just a teacher, composer, lecturer, writer. In America, he meant so much more.